Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Chris Flint, and welcome to yet another special edition of the Roker Report, where today we take you back 30-plus years, which is frightening, to probably my favourite era as a Sunderland fan. Today we have a player who came through the ranks in Division 1, Division 2, and Division 3 for Sunderland over the course of 7 years, making well over 300 appearances between 1987 and 1994. He was a big hero of mine when I was young, so today I'm privileged to be speaking to none other than Gary Howard. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much. Thank you for reminding me that was 30 years ago. Feeling very old sat here.
It's frightening. Well, it's great to speak to you. Hopefully today we can convince maybe some of the younger Sunderland fans that it is possible for Sunderland to get back in the top five from our current position. We'll see with that one. On that note, do you get along to see Sunderland much these days?
Well, not as much as I'd like. I've got to be honest, my two boys who were both born and raised in Bristol are sort of follow Sunderland avidly over the years. We got along to the League Cup final against Man City, been to one or two away games, Portsmouth last year, final at Wembley again against Portsmouth, Swansea a couple of seasons ago, seems a lifetime ago in the Premier League. Yeah. That was a great victory that night. And recently, because of our location, we went along to the Bristol Rovers game, stood on the terrace, the open end with the Sunderland fans, and rather disappointedly witnessed the 2-0 defeat. So we go when we can. Obviously, I work on a Saturday as well. I cover Bristol City for BBC Radio Bristol. So the actual times when I'm available to go and watch Sunderland are quite limited, but still follow them week in, week out. Everybody down here is talking about the Netflix programme, but I can't bring myself to watch the first one. But I feel the pain, and I've watched the first two of the second episode, so let's see.
Yeah, I went through it once. I don't think I'll do it again. I'll aim for this to be the last time I mention current events, but how are you coping with the lockdown?
Like everybody else, you've got to get on with it. You know, we've all been set a task by the government. We got to stay in and, you know, protect lives. I think it's an important message. None of us are enjoying our freedom being taken away. I think the thing for me, a couple of weeks ago, football was life and death. And here we all are now sat indoors with nothing to do, watching the terrible events unfold in front of us on the TV. And we realise that maybe football isn't as important as we think it is sometimes, although, you know, we're all missing it. The thing that it is important, I think, is in terms of our emotional, psychological and mental well-being. We all need that football fix. Makes us feel good sometimes. Makes us feel bad a lot of the time, but we need it. And hopefully this will blow over and we'll all get back out there again and be able to enjoy our football again.
On that, let us go back to when football was the most important thing in the world. And what I'd like to do is start from the beginning. I think I read somewhere it was George Hurd, who was the youth development officer at the time. He spotted you playing for Chesley Street under-15s and brought you to the club.
Yeah, right? I mean, it was different then in them days. It's not like now. If you get spotted now, kids are going in at 6 and 7 and staying there all the way through until they're playing the first team. That wasn't the model then. You could sign for a club when you were 14. I'd been away. I'd had a few trials. I'd been to Coventry, Notts County, Middlesbrough for some reason. It just shows that them clubs were represented in the North East, which was a bit of a hotbed. Sunderland had spotted us playing for Chesley Street, probably against Sunderland boys, I think. I think probably Lee Howie and Steve Howie and people like that were playing for Sunderland, and went along to training. George Hurd asked me to sign for Sunderland, and I was there all the way from 15 until I left, I think, when I was 25 or 26.
It was a difficult decision because I think, I'm sure you grew up a Newcastle fan.
Well, I did, and you can't help where you're born. I always say that. I was well-travelled, actually. My dad, who left home when I was young, was in the army. I think we'd lived in Lincoln. My sister was born in Lincoln. We'd lived in the barracks in Newcastle somewhere, then sort of moved around Winlayton, Beacon Loft East, which was in Gateshead, and then sort of settled more really later on in Birtley in Washington at around the age when I signed for Sunderland. So lots of Newcastle fans around in the family. But like I say, when you stay with the club as long as I did, and you know, I put my heart and soul into it, it's often levelled against us, but you know, Sunderland rose my club.
So what was the Sunderland kind of youth set up like at the time, and who were your biggest influences when you were coming through?
Well, I mean, George Hurd was a great guy, very enthusiastic. There was a Sunderland lad, a youth coach called Ian Hughes, which he was a very good coach at that time. So we sort of signed schoolboys, and then you get a decision made whether you're going to get an apprenticeship or not. I got an apprenticeship, and at that time, it was the time Laurie McMenemy was manager, actually. So Chris McMenemy come in as our youth coach, and again he was only a young lad. You don't realise at the time we were 16 and 17. I think Chris was only 23 or 24, and obviously being Laurie's son, he had quite a bit of pressure on him. He took a bit of stick now and again, I think, from the first team players. But in terms of being a coach, he was a brilliant coach. Certainly guided me through the first couple of years of my apprenticeship up to the point where you're going to get a decision made on whether you get a professional contract or not. I was in with a group of about 10 or 11 players, and you know, that day come where you had to go up, and it was frightening. I mean, Laurie McMenemy was a pretty imposing figure. We were all scared stiff of him, you know, ex-sergeant major. Things weren't going great, and you sort of kept away from the first team, if I'm honest. And to go and sit in his office was quite daunting. So we went one by one. You know, the lads were coming down in tears. It wasn't to be for them. They all had the dreams shattered. I went up, and I must have done all right. He offered us a 2-year contract.
Were you ever close to getting involved in the first team under McMenemy? Because I think I remember you got an injury as Sunderland were relegated.
Yeah, I actually, he said I would. Those clubs, because I know when Dennis Smith come from York, the first thing he said was, "I've been trying to sign you on loan for 2 years to play in this first team." So I'd actually, there's a friendly, I think, up at Bishop Auckland. They got beat. I mean, they couldn't win a game, and they'd gone to play this game, and they got beat. I'd featured in that. Might have been a local, one of the Durham County Cup games or something like that. Anyway, I featured in that. But I think when I come back in my second season, or when I was 17, my first season as a pro, they actually shattered my arm on the training ground. And I think if I hadn't done that, I probably would have played earlier. Although there were a few people, to be honest, who said it wasn't a bad thing, because I would have probably ended up playing in that team that got relegated. And that might not have been the best thing for me at that time in terms of, you know, going into that environment.
You never know, though. You could have popped up with a goal against Gillingham.
Well, I mean, that game, it's funny you say that. We sat and watched that. We had to be there. Obviously, we were working there, and we'd clean the dressing rooms and that, and we all used to turn up after our games. That was a playoff game. It was all different. And I remember that game. There was so much. You know, I remember the fences being up around Roker Park. Yeah. Remember that there was, you know, it was packed with Sunderland fans, it was packed with Gillingham fans, and you'll know there was, and this is a sign of the times, and it was a terrible thing, there was a section for Newcastle fans as well, because they had come to put their 2 pennies worth in, and they had to segregate them. And I remember Keith Burchin scoring. It was a high scoring game. Keith Burchin scored, and he took off as if Sunderland had won the league, and you know, he'd rescued them from relegation. And I think they're still getting beat. He just lost count of the score. I think I'd read somewhere that he didn't even know what the score was. He just thought he'd scored the winner. But, you know, it was a dreadful thing at the time. And you know, for Sunderland, massive club, massive support to get relegated into the third division for the first time in history.
What I wanted to ask you about the end of that season, because Bob Stokoe came in. I mean, did he have any impact on the club or on you, or was he just not there?
No, he didn't. And I've got to be honest. I mean, he's a legend. You know, I've seen all the cup final stuff, 1973. Still see some of them boys. They're proper. You know, Jimmy Montgomery, Bobby Kerr, people like that. Fantastic people, great club people, great individuals. Couldn't speak highly enough of them. And I never really ever seen or met Bob Stokoe. I don't think, other than he'd been around. Obviously, he was around the club now and again. He'd pop in. But thinking back, it was sort of, I think it was something done to try and lift the crowd, try and get a bit of belief in the crowd. He was a figurehead. I think he'd probably been out the game a long time. He took Chris in as his assistant. I think he knew more, you know, he knew more about the players that had been left behind by his father. I mean, obviously it didn't have the desired effect, but in terms of dealing with the young players and that, I think he was there to concentrate on the senior players and somehow try and perform a miracle to get them out of that relegation playoff game, which obviously he couldn't do.
Well, it did end in relegation, and it appeared from the outside that summer that kind of Dennis Smith walked in and picked the club up by the scruff of the neck. I mean, was that the case when he first joined?
He did. And let's be honest, you know, everyone, Laurie McMenemy, got slayed at the time, and he was, in terms of my relationship with him, and I didn't have a massive one, but he knew who I was, and he was good to me. He recognised that I had something, and he gave me the chance to stay there. And obviously, when he left me in a position of having a two-year contract, obviously, as well. His son, Chris, had been influential in my development. Dennis walked through the door pretty much straight away. Small squad, loads of young players in the team. I mean, it's incredible. You go through I look at some of the team photos, and there's only like 16 or 17 players on the team photo, and I think, where's everybody else? Like, you look at the team photos now, and there's like 30 or 40 people in them. But, yeah. You know, we took off. I think we had five pre-season games. I think we won them all, even though I think we played Ryup and Harrogate. And, you know, we weren't like going and playing great teams, but I just think it was quite clever. He got us together quickly. We got a bit of confidence. I was involved in the games. You know, I'd started coming to pre-season. There's no way that I thought that at the start of pre-season I was going to make my debut in the first league game. That was just, you know, it wasn't on my mind. I was thinking about trying to hopefully at some point break into the first team, maybe catch someone's eye in the reserves and get a loan somewhere in the league.
Yeah.
But, you know, we got the opening game against Brentford, and pretty early in the week he told us I was going to be playing, which was unbelievable.
Yeah, I was going to say, so, you know, obviously Sunderland's now in the third division, opening day of the season, 15th of August 1987. You make your full debut for the club. You're 18 years old. It's away to Brentford, and we win 1-0 through a goal from Keith Burton. I mean, that must have been...
Yeah, he's allowed to celebrate that one. That was a winning goal, thankfully, for Keith. Actually, that's a good point. I've never thought about that. He might have scored. Could be a quiz question. And unless anyone scored after him, he might have scored the last goal in the second division and the first goal in the third division.
Yeah. I mean, what are your memories of your debut that day?
Well, we travelled down overnight. I know that we stayed in a hotel beside Heathrow, because in the morning we got up and had breakfast. I think I might have shared a room with John Kay. And it was just... I remember the aeroplanes. You know, we sat outside and the aeroplanes were going across one after another, and they were like, you only seemed like they were 200 feet above the hotel. So God knows how I'd slept the night before. But I just remember it being really, really hot, very hot. And I played left wing. So I'd found myself positioned left wing somehow, being quite a tight game. I remember Keith's goal, soaring header, if I remember correctly. And then, I mean, the last thing I remember, I think it was probably 76 minutes or something, I got this pain in my calf, which I'd never had before. And it was cramp, obviously, the nerves and the dehydration and the occasion it got to us. And I think I probably went off. I'm not sure. I think I probably went off after about 76 minutes with cramp, but went off feeling very, very happy with myself. And I think I'd earned my first appearance bonus and my first win bonus.
Well, you were joined that day. You mentioned you shared a room with John Kay. I mean, he made his debut that day, and so did John McPhail. So these were players that Dennis Smith started to bring in. And I mean, look, with those characters we just mentioned, I mean, football was a very different place back then. Was that a typical dressing room to come in at that age?
Do you know what? That was the best thing. Like, you talk about the football, the games, all of that. For me, the best things, it was the team spirit. You know, them lads, we did everything together. We went everywhere together. We spent hours on the bus travelling. We spent hours in each other's company in hotels, staying overnight. We went away at the end of the season, sometimes during the season. Some of the things, some of the laughs. You know, that I think it was probably it was the happiest time in my life, I've got to be honest. It was brilliant. You know, if I ever, and I'm not threatening to, don't worry. If I ever wrote a book, it probably wouldn't be on the football. It would be on some of the things that happened outside the football. We had so many great characters, you know, people, Casey, like you say, John McPhail, Gary Bennett, Eric Gates, Dickie Ord, who's my big, big buddy still to this day, Gordon Armstrong, later on Don Goodman, Anton Rogan, all them people that you know, it was just, and Dennis and Viv, and later on Malcolm, they were behind that, and that was, I think that was why we did have some success, because of the team spirit. And actually, the sad thing was, when it started to fall apart, that was maybe one of the reasons why it did, because, you know, that spirit just started to whittle away a little bit.
We'll come on to that. But actually, if that's the case, if there's going to be a book like that, I mean, that's a book that has to be written, in my view. I think in this lockdown, you should get started.
For permission.
Yeah, I mean, but just talking about your debut, because we're at third division, and I think Sunderland might have experienced this last season. Was there a lot of pressure on Sunderland kind of winning that day, just getting into the third division? We're a big club.
Nah, we need to win. He never put any pressure on us, Dennis, whatsoever. I think the pressure, I don't know whether it was clever or by chance or just what happened. There was a lot of young players in the team, like I said before, lots of local lads. There weren't any pressure. It was an honour for us. It was a privilege. The support's brilliant now. The support back in them days was scary. You know, when we went away from home, 5,000-6,000 at home. We were really well supported, so we just wanted to win. We got off to a good start. We hit the ground running, and we got up there pretty quickly in the proceedings and stayed there, you know, all season, which was good.
Well, on that point, I mean, we talked about the impact of Dennis Smith, but actually, we didn't actually get off to the best of starts. We only won 3 of the first 9. And we found ourselves...
Well, it shows how good my memory is.
we were actually 12 towards the end of September. But two things happened around that time that probably had a big bearing on the course of the season.
What you're going to say. One is, I think you signed Marco.
Yeah, we did. That was the second one. But I'd actually say the first one was Keith Burton picking up an injury that gave Eric Gates a chance to get back in. And then we combined those two kind of probably bit by design, a bit by chance. Then we go on to win the next 6 through kind of October, December, November, and we never really look back, won the third division title. But was it those two things happening, you think, that just got us going?
Marco had a massive influence when he come in. Cocky, to be honest. Very, very confident. Different type of player. I think he played against Sunderland the season before in a cup game, and he's only a young lad. If I remember, he played up front with Keith Walwyn. And Dennis was the manager, so he knew him very well. He knew what he was getting. You know, he could win a game on his own. He'd always tell you that. You know, Marco would always tell you he was the best player. But more often than not, in fairness, he was. But Gatesy looked after me, in all honesty. And I love him to bits, Eric. I used to sit beside him in the first team dressing room when I'd gone from sitting in the sort of youth team and reserve team dressing room. You move up, it's a big thing, and you don't like get given a peg. You've got to go and find one yourself. So you sort of like, well, in fairness, it was a little bit easier in them days because you're getting rid of most of the team from the season before. So there was lots of space in the dressing room, but I picked one, I think, in between Eric and Ruben Agboola, and Eric sort of took us under his arm a little bit, and he spent a lot of time with us, talking to us, and fair play to him. because he'd been there. He'd come from Ipswich, big reputation. He'd been an excellent player, played in Europe with Ipswich, top quality player, played for England. And he'd had a tough time and he stuck it out. You know, he stuck it out. He showed his character. He showed what an excellent player he was. And obviously, I think they were good for each other because if you got the ball into Eric's feet, which you had to, because that's he made it easy for me. He used to say to me, and he said, the first thing he'd say to us, which is, when you get the ball, all I want you to do is look for me. He says, and if you pass it to me feet, I'll give you a pat on the back. He says, and if you don't, I'm going to give you a ball again. So it was easy. So I thought, because you're good more than Eric as well. So I'd get the ball and I think I'd give it to Eric, and everyone would give it to Eric. He'd get on the half turn. That's why he had them big calves, because he used to get kicked in those days off the centre halves. They get on the half turn and he just flicked it in behind the centre halves. None of them were ever as quick as Marco, and you know, Mark would end up smashing it in the back of the net. And it sounds pretty simple and straightforward, but I mean, that's if you see lots of the goals, I'm sure that's how they play out.
I think people forget sometimes that football is a simple game. There was a story in Dennis Smith's book, I mean, just along the same lines as what you just said there, where when Burton got injured, he had a word with Eric Gates, and Eric Gates just turned around and said, if you get the ball into my feet, I've watched Margot, I'll just stick him in and he can do the rest. That's pretty much
how it was. He did. I mean, he was a great guy, Eric, and he's still around up there. When I go up there, it's always lovely to bump into him. Funny as you like, tells the best stories ever. You know, he used to tell a story, he'd have everyone hanging on every word, and he'd always start laughing at his own jokes and his own stories, which made them even more entertaining. But, you know, top class player, top player. And to be fair, it's a bit unfair on Keith Burton as well, because he was a great player, really good pro, had a good career. And sometimes in football, it's just how these things pan out.
Yeah, I've been to a couple of talk-ins with Eric Gates, and they're always good fun. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he took a lot of stick, but it ended up kind of a hero when he did finally leave. And he said he was brilliant during the season. We went on to kind of romp home with the third division, win the title, got promotion to Division Two. And we get the trophy at the end of your season, the first season as a professional, in front of 29,000 at Roker Park against Northampton Town. I mean, for your first full season as a professional footballer, 18, 19 years old, you started 43 games in all competitions that season. So I mean, that's a pretty special start to your Sunderland career, and a great way to end it at Roker, picking up the trophy.
It was. I have to admit, I was disappointed because I broke my foot towards the end of the season, and it cost us a lot. I think I'd been called up to one of the England youth squads, so I missed out on that, and I missed out on the Northampton game, obviously full house, and I've seen a few pictures and sat on the dugout, and you know, again in those days it used to be the manager, the physio, the assistant manager, the coach, which was Buzzer, and the sub. I think there was only one sub. There was only one sub in them days. It's incredible, really. And, yeah. And then the next season there might have been when they started having two subs, so you had a bit of company. But yeah, it was brilliant, and you don't realise it, to win a league, even though we were a massive club, we were expected to win it. It's a massive achievement to win any league. You know, you've got to play all them games, small squads, the squads are really small, you've got to spend a lot of time on the pitch. I don't know, I don't get the modern game where they get rested because they're tired. When we only had one sub, sometimes the sub never got on, or you never seemed to get injured, or if you had an injury, you played through it, where now they've got umpteen subs, and you know, they have to make so many substitutions. It's incredible when you think back, really.
Well, actually, you mentioned that Northampton game. It was Richard Orden, John Cornforth on the bench, and you know, 3-1 up, party time, we're going to get the trophy, and Dennis Smith doesn't bring either of them on.
He's probably trying to save appearance money. Probably going to cost him a few quid in win bonuses, so he's probably trying to save it for the chairman. Yeah. But no, I mean, if you think, goodness me, Dickie must have been probably 17, and Corny must have been a year older than me, probably 19 or 20, so it just shows how young a squad we were.
Well, I mean, what an achievement, though, to do that first time of asking. I know you did have some good senior pros, like we've mentioned, Gates, Bennett. I mean, Agboola was in there, McPhail was in there.
Frank Gray, another excellent player.
Frank Gray, Ian Hesford in goal. But, you know, you're mixing that up with, you know, the likes of yourself, the likes of Gordon Armstrong, Marco Gabbadini, Colin Pascoe came in late in the season. John Kerr was, 23, 24 at the time. So, I mean, but a fantastic achievement to bounce straight back up.
No, it was great. Like I say, God, if only Sunderland could have done it the second time. they've been relegated to the same level, and that's the pressure that they're under at the moment. Well, like I said, we didn't feel pressure, but the club was probably under pressure, and the fans stuck with us. They didn't expect us to ever be at that level, and thankfully for them, we got through it, and you know, we worked our way quite quickly through, however it happened, to get back in the top division.
Yeah, I think as big as the achievement just to bounce straight back up into the second division, the following season we kind of consolidated our position in Division 2 by finishing 11th, and we had a kind of a flirt with the playoffs around Christmas, but kind of fell away to 11th. And you have a second season in a row where you play over 40 games in all competitions. So now you've made almost 100 appearances before your 19th birthday. Gordon Armstrong, who's a year older, has played about 150 games before his 20th birthday, which is pretty amazing.
Well, it is.
See in the modern game.
It is. And again, if you relate that to the modern game, you won't see it. It doesn't happen. And, you know, I sit back, I'm sitting here in my garden now, and it seems like another life when I played football. You know, you said it was 30 years ago, but, you know, it was pretty amazing. I tried to sort my lad, my youngest son, he's just got his first contract at Bristol City. He's just got a 3-year contract. So I try and explain to him that when I was his age, I was playing in the first team for Sunderland every week, and he can't believe it.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, but do you think that, for you, for likes of yourself and Gordon Armstrong, do you think that was too much football at that age looking back now?
Yes, but no. I mean, we didn't have any option. We wouldn't have had it any other way. We wanted to play every week. I mean, the thing was now is I played till I was 34 in the league. If it was now, if we come in the game now, we both wouldn't have played as many games at that age, but we probably both would have played until we were 40, because we used to, you know, we weren't just putting it in. Honestly, we trained so hard. Every training session was like a game. You know, we were running our cobblers off during the week and weren't resting. And we probably did overtrain. But, you know, it was, you had to learn on your feet. We're young men. We got through it. We got help from the senior pros, which was amazing. When you think of some of the, like you say, people like Eric Gates and Frank Gray helping you, we were fortunate. And, we got a lot of experience pretty early on in our careers.
Yeah, an amazing amount of football. But going into the following season in Division 2, we finished 11th the season before. Newcastle and Middlesbrough came down to join us from the First Division. They were relegated. There was Leeds in there, West Ham. There were some big clubs looking at getting promoted back to the First Division that season. By this point, we've added Tony Norman and Colin Pascoe, who were the kind of big signings all since we were in the Third Division. And then we had Paul Hardiman during that summer. But was it that season, was it a clear aim to get promoted, even though we'd just been in the Third Division?
I don't know. I don't recall ever having a meeting at the start of the season where anybody ever said, right, we've got to win promotion this season or we're going to try. And it was like, we were never put under that pressure. We're always under pressure because of the size of the club, and the supporters craved that we got back to the top division because of the proud history of the club. I suppose it's one of them stupid things you see in football, is that we wait for the games to come around, and we just got on with it when the games come. You know, there were times during those first three seasons where once we got on a roll, that's when we were at our best. And I think that probably happened that season, towards the end of the season, if I remember.
Well, early that season, we went out and signed Paul Bracewell. Just how big a signing was that for the club that season, and what impact did he have on your game that year?
Well, I've got to be honest, he had a big impact on me as a person. He was another player who did a lot for us. I'd had a few problems at home, and he, you know, there were times when I was actually staying with Paul. So I was always thankful to Paul and his wife for sort of looking after us during that difficult period. He was a quality player. We'd seen him obviously feature for England. He'd struggle with injury. He was very much his own man, and I don't think he'd ever mind me saying that. He sort of looked after himself in terms of how he was as a professional. So he kept himself fit. He ate the right things, but he was also quite ruthless as a person, and he wanted the best. He wanted to play in the best possible team, and he had high standards. There were times when everybody probably didn't appreciate some of the things he did or said, but he was an excellent player for Sunderland and had a massive influence at the time.
He's one of the best midfielders I've seen play for Sunderland.
And for somebody that couldn't run, goodness me, if he could ever run in his life, he would have been top class.
Yeah. See the old videos of when he played for Everton, and he's almost like a Frank Lampard type. He's kind of box to box. He was the first in the box, almost ahead of the strikers. I mean, if he didn't get injured,
terrible ankle injuries. And but it was, again, credit to him how he got himself. He understood his body. He knew what he could do and what he couldn't do, and he managed that.
Yeah, well, around that time, actually, you're also called up to the England under-21 squad. So how was that experience? Was it Dave Sexton at the time?
Yeah, Dave Sexton. Being called up, I was really unlucky on that front, to be honest. I'd been called up the season before for England under-20s. They were going to play in the under-20 World Cup in Brazil. I think Marco might have went, actually. We'd both been called up. At the end of the season, had got an ingrown toenail, which got infected. And really turned quite nasty on us. So I sort of spent the summer in Magaluf, walking around in flip-flops with the rest of the team, rather than on the beach in Rio with England. But anyway, I got a chance, got a late call-up, and we were going to Poland. So I can't remember. How did I went down to Luton, actually travelled down to Luton Airport, all very, very quickly. Got on the plane, looking around on the plane, there's like Terry Butcher, Steve McMahon, Peter Shilton, Brian Robson, all these people. I'm sat there, and I was a bit starstruck, to be honest. We then separated at the airport, but one thing I remember at the airport, we arrived in Poland, Katowice, I think, and Bobby Robson was England manager, and obviously there's always sort of late call-ups to both the squads because of injuries on the weekend or the preceding game. So the lads that had been called up late now, as one of them, didn't have visas for Poland. So we were sort of denied access initially. So we all sat in this little room in Poland, and in walks Bobby Robson, and you think, what's in? And Bobby Robson sat with us. There was three, I can't remember who the other, about three or four of us. And he come in and he sat with us, and it must have been well over an hour. And he would not go through with the rest of the team until every one of his players had been cleared. And I thought that, you know, at the time that was unbelievable. I'm thinking, I'm sat in this room with Bobby Robson, and he's waiting for me to take me through. And that was, you know, he was a tremendous man. So we had to, I think we separated. We played first. I was on the bench, never got on. So that meant I didn't get a cap. But I think we won our game, I think 3-0. I'm trying to think who played in the team. Probably Gazza, if I recall. Gascoigne, Merson, David Batty. I think I shared a room with Brian Dean, with Brian Dean in Poland for one night. And I can't remember much more other than the fact that we had to go to the full senior game on the next night. And I think England had to get a point to qualify for the World Cup. So we arrive in this stadium, and obviously the Polish are going absolutely mental, like proper, in those days, proper football hooligans everywhere. We get off in all our England and basically attacked straight away with wooden planks and everything. So we get put in this, in the stadium, inside the ground, in the middle of all the Polish supporters, fearing for our lives. And it was unbelievable. And we're watching the game. If Poland had won, they would have went through instead of England. And I think about 20 seconds left, one of their midfielders had a shot from about 30 yards, which smacked across Peter Shilton's crossbar. If it had gone in, England would have been out. But they got the point, I think, got through, and I think it's fair to say that some of them senior lads sank a few drinks on the way back. Gazza taking a light in the Baileys at that point and entertained everyone from the front row. But it was sort of a famous flight, I think, in terms of Brian Robson got up halfway through the flight and made a speech, sort of pretty much nailing the British sports press, who were all sat at the back of the plane. So probably eating a little bit of humble pie because the abuse that they'd levelled at Bobby Robson.
Good timing for being in the under-21 squad. You got to see all that.
Well, it was like I say, you take it all in. You know, it's like, who are all these people? And people like you watch on TV, you're sitting beside. It was incredible.
That was the game, I'm sure, the Poland game. That was the game after the Sweden one when Butcher was all kind of covered in blood and had the headband on, and sure, that was the game before that one. But yeah, and also that year, just I think wasn't that too long after the under-21 call up. It was also the year that Gary Bennett and David Speedy had a small disagreement that ended.
Well, it did.
David Speedy being in the Clockstand Paddocks.
It did, and I still watch that. And the referee, actually, David Allinson, he's in charge of the refs now. And every time I bump into him, he recalls that moment. But it's unbelievable. You see that now in the television camera. Couldn't have been a better place, really, could it? Because, I mean, he was a good player, David Speedy. That was a quarter final, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
League Cup quarter final. Again, it shows how close we were to getting some success. We should have beat them that night. Obviously, that happened. Speedy went into the clock stand paddock, and him and Benno were sent off. Actually, it had big consequences for me, because in the second leg, it was a replay, wasn't it? It was a replay. We went to Highfield Road, and pretty early in the game, actually, I'd gone for a ball with David Speedy. So there was a bit of aggravation. It was never like he wasn't singled out, or it was like, just be aware, he'll try and suck you in. And I brushed past him. I won the ball. And as I brushed past him, I stuck my arm out. He went down like a sack off. And I got a red card. And then, obviously, went down to 10 men. I think we lost 5-0. I got battered by Dennis. Obviously, fined a couple of weeks' wages. But, that was a big, big disappointment.
Yeah, it was a big game. It was a good crowd as well at Roker.
Never gets spoken about ever, really. You think that was a quarter final. What's that there? Yeah. So we were very close again.
We had a pretty awful record in the League Cup, and that was pretty much the closest we got for about 20 years.
Well, not that all, because I'd been to the final in 1985. I was a schoolboy at the time. We'd all travel down to watch that, and see another disappointment at Wembley for Sunderland.
we'll come on to another Wembley appearance in a minute, because we'll get to the business end, because we ended up finishing sixth of that season, of course, and that means the playoffs. Now, the playoffs are always huge, but this time our opponents were Newcastle United in the semi-finals. Yeah. They finished third. It was billed as one of the biggest games between the two sides in history, and I wouldn't like to imagine the build-up in the modern day, but how was it back in May 1990?
Wow, it was brilliant. Just how it worked out, it was unbelievable, really. There's always that rivalry, but in terms of the games itself, how the games panned out, the first game was very, very tight, very, very tense, pretty violent at times, I would have to say. There was quite a few well-contested tackles all over the pitch.
Yeah.
There's one on YouTube, I think, I make on Mark Stimson in the second half. But actually, I think I've either dreamt this or I've made this up. I don't think I have. I think this is how I recall it, because in those days you could pretty much guess what teams are going to do from the kickoff. So we're all revved up. You know, I'm in front of the clock stand paddock, and they're all like, you know, they'd all be cheering you on and trying to get you up for the game. Not that you needed it for that game. And so I knew Newcastle kicked off. And you can check this. If you've got the video, check it. And then if it didn't happen, I'm a total liar and I'm thinking about the second challenge. But I knew that when they kicked off, the ball was going to go to the left back, Mark Stimson. So we're all lined up. And I think I probably set off about 3 seconds before the ref blew his whistle. So I'm thinking, I've set off here. Surely then I'm going to pass it back to the left back. Because if he does, he might have a little bit of a problem. Anyway, my eyes lights up, because what do? They pass it straight at the left back. So he has got to have a touch. He's either got to just kick it first time, which he won't, because that's not going to look too good from the kickoff, and have it. And I think if he has a touch, I'm getting. So he has a touch, and I'm thinking, right, he's had a touch. And I know that I'm taking off now, and it's not a tackle, it's more like a long jump. So I'm sort of taking off now. And I know that as soon as he kicks the ball, I'm going to get there at exactly the same time as he tries to kick the ball. So I'm thinking he might have a problem, because I'm going in low and hard. My studs are up a little bit maybe, and I'm going to get full contact on the ball. He's kicking it, and he's going to kick through my studs. So anyway, it happens, and I get there, and there's a thud. So I think, oh God, get in, you hear the cheer from the crowd. So I'm like, I've gone in low, I've shut my eyes, and I've sort of opened them, and I'm open my eyes, I think, where's he gone? He's disappeared, right? So, you know, if you think, I'm on the floor and the left back was there a second ago and now he's not there. I'm thinking, where's he gone? So, you know, like when you sat in your garden today, like today, and like a cloud goes over, and the shadow goes over, and it sort of, I felt this shadow go over my head. And I just looked up and I seen Mark Stimson doing a somersault over my head. It was unbelievable. And I think, well, that was it. Probably, I've probably got put a marker down early in the game. But there was another one exactly the same in the second half, but the ball was bouncing, and it was him again. And to be fair, he went for them both, and when the second game come round, he made sure he got a couple in on me early, I can tell you. But just time, and you get on the ball, and there's, you know, thunderous tackles that were part of the game then, but you wouldn't see them anymore now. You'd be sent straight off. So that anyway, the first game, everyone knows we got a late penalty. John Burridge saved it. Paul Ordiman then sort of trying to kick John Burridge's head into the back of the forward end. Got a red card. And we were come off 0-0, was it? 0-0. Yep. And going to obviously go to St. James's Park and get hammered. And we had to listen to that for a couple of days.
Actually, just on that, I've read somewhere that after the first leg of Roker, kind of you could hear the Newcastle players celebrating as if they were already through. And a few players from the time have said that really fired you up kind of straight away for that second leg.
I couldn't say that I recall that. I'd think that they would have been well happy with getting a draw. Yeah. You know, you would be, wouldn't you? You know, that you think, always think that's the hard part done. You always fancy yourself at home. Actually, I bet you if you look at Newcastle's home record that season as well, I bet you they hadn't lost many at home. Mickey Quinn scoring for fun. Mark McGee, I think.
What our away record that year is incredible.
Yeah, but we, you know, we've been on a run, like I said before. I think we've gone into them games on a winning away from home for fun, you know, and spirit was high. We're having the time of our lives. Obviously, this is crunch time, isn't it? So I remember the night, what I remember, horrible night, pitch, like awful, soaking wet. You'd think, would it be played in the modern day? We go out there, get off to a good start. I think it was down the right-hand side. I sort of chased the ball, just got there. We bounced up a little bit awkward. I managed to hook it in. Gatesy, who probably hadn't scored, I don't think. He hadn't scored for a few games. Gets on the end of it. He's delighted. We get off to a good start. You know, they tried hard. We were excellent. I think we played excellent. We defended excellent. Tony Norman made all the saves he had to make. Benno, who's probably Monty as well, a back four, just stood firm. We always looked like we'd catch him on the break. And that's what we did. Obviously, the second goal, if you see it, is that typical Gates-Gabbiadini combination that we're talking about earlier. I think gets played into Werrick. He just flips it behind. Marco, pace and power. And it's all over. Unbelievable. We think we're through. We probably, you know, we knew we were. Obviously, when I say that, we weren't anticipating what happened next. We probably were, because we'd been told that there's no way that you're either getting out of here alive tonight, boys, or winning the game. So on the come, sort of, they're all running on towards the losers' end, where all the Sunderland fans, that end, I don't know how they got all them Sunderland fans into that end. And they stood there, and it's pouring down. They got absolutely soaked, but all these Newcastle, but they're running on, and they're running on, and it's like, whoa, we're going to. They get across the halfway line. It looks like they're thinking, oh dear, what we're going to do now? So, anyway, George Courtney, who was a ref, he was calm, calmest man on the pitch. He'd sort of taken us off, and there's a few Newcastle players probably saying, "Oh, you can't let this happen. You've got to abandon it." And George Courtney, and I've said it before, he says, listen, I'm going to stay here. He had the ball behind his back. He said, I'm going to stay here all night. He says, I'm not bothered if there's no one in the ground when we finish this game, but we're going to finish this game. So that sort of reassured us. I'm on the right wing in the second half. I've got cramp. So I'm thinking, I've run myself into the ground. I think I had a good chance second half. Keeping me, I had a couple of good chances actually in the game. Probably should have scored. I'm thinking, right, George had said later in the game, there's 3 minutes left. I'll give you a 3 minute warning. When it gets down to the last 30 seconds, I'll tell you, start preparing to get off the pitch. So he played about a minute. He played about a minute and blew his whistle and legged it. So I'm like on the far side trying to get off. Everybody's like, it's like, you know, it's like the old cricket test. Everyone's running down the tunnel, every man for themselves. And you know, you can look back. I look back and I laugh now. I think Monty gets a kick up the arse. One or two of the other lads get the sneaky clip around the ear. I think I got off. I was quite fortunate. I got off unscathed. And, you know, you go into the dressing room and, you know, it was just an unbelievable place to be. Best dressing room I've ever been in ever after a game. It was, you know, we'd done it not only, you know, we were going to the final. Not only were we going to the final, we had a chance of promotion. We'd done it by beating Newcastle. And the worst thing about it was the fact that the police wouldn't let us back out. They wouldn't let us back down the tunnel, probably for our own safety. But to go out, and it would have been to go and celebrate with the fans at the end of that game would have been unbelievable. We denied that, but I think they were happy. You know, it was an unbelievable night. We piled on the bus. The bus went straight from St James's Park. So if you think that when we went to the game, there's probably the players on there, the staff, the management, a couple of players, maybe it's 20. I reckon when it left St James's Park to go, and it didn't go to the ground. I think it went straight to Fino's. Pulled up outside Fino's. Seriously, there must have been 60 people on that bus. It was swaying. And we all had them white Hummel tracksuits on with whatever coloured bottoms. And I tell you what, they looked great in Fino's under them neon lights. But we had the best night of our lives. And it's one of them where you wake up the next day and you're filled with elation and you're proud and you're just trying to reflect on what had happened. It actually probably took 2 or 3 days. You normally you get high when you're in football, and that's what I miss. You know, you get high, you get buzz. Nothing else can give you it. And then certainly when you finish playing, you miss it. But I think that one went on for days and days, and rightly so. We again, the spirit, we're having the time of our lives. We just won the biggest game in recent times, the biggest game that many of us had played in, and we're all pleased to do it.
Yeah. You say days and days. I'd say years and years.
Yeah, well, maybe.
It's one of the most famous nights in Sunderland's history.
It was. It's a shame. It's never really recognised, is it? It's spoken about. And actually, it was probably. When I look back, it was probably one of my best ever games, I think, for Sunderland. So I'm quite pleased about that.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, just as a little side issue for that second leg, and Dennis Smith seemed to pull a rabbit out of his hat because he pulled in Warren Hawke from Norway for the game and put him in the starting 11.
I knew he'd played Warren. And again, he's a young player. Dennis was never scared to put anyone in the team. And however, you know, he put young players in the team, Warren, Hawke. You know, he put Dickie in when he was 17. He would do that. I can only think that there must have been... Well, obviously, there was one player missing, I think, because Paul Hardiman was probably suspended, so he had to make one change.
I mean, that you obviously had to settle down, and everyone had to settle down because we had the final still to play. And it was actually the first year it was played as a one-off game at Wembley because it had been two legs before then. But, you know, your second or third full season... You know, we'll get to Wembley. I mean, how was the build-up to that big Wembley game? Because now it's billed as kind of the biggest game in football now.
Yeah, well, it is. Again, another... People, you talk about games, and I do bits and bobs, and people speak to us, and they say, oh, it's the biggest game you play. I say, oh, well, I tell them about the Newcastle game. I tell them I played in the Cup Final. I tell them I played in the Championship. And they're like, what, you played in all them games? I'm like, yeah, before I was 23 as well. And, you know, the build-up... The build-up was, I've got to be honest, and it's a long time ago. I think something that we might have got wrong, not blaming Dennis, we actually, so you think that you come to the end of the season and the lads like want to let off a bit of steam and you'd wait till all the games are out the way and you go away on your end of season trip. We went to Menorca, I think, for 4 or 5 days, and it was half team building, bonding, which we didn't have to do. Because we could have went to South Shields and the spirit would have been the same. But it was a bit of sun. Took us away. I suppose it took us away from the pressure a little bit. But interesting that was sort of squeezed in between beating Newcastle and the playoff final.
I was going to say, because Bob Murray has said in an interview since that he'd had an idea that we'd kind of go up regardless of the result. I mean, did the players know any of this? Well, he talked about you kind of going on all day for a few days.
We'd heard it. It wasn't, and I don't want to go back because I don't know, and I don't want to say anything that isn't true. But as I recall, Gordon McKeague was Newcastle's chairman. He was also on the board at the Football League. And the Football League had this situation that was ongoing with Swindon, and it was highly embarrassing at the time. And the worst possible scenario was that Swindon got to the final, which they did. I think they were probably hoping that they got knocked out in the semi-final, and that would have solved the problem for them, but it didn't. Swindon were an excellent team. They got through the final. They're still left with this argument. And if I say that we hadn't heard rumours, I'd be lying, but we did sort of have an inkling that the winners of the Newcastle-Sunderland game would have a chance of getting promoted if Swindon got demoted. I mean, that's how it turned out, but who knows what was going on at the time. We still had to go and play the game.
Yeah, well, in the game itself, really early on, Colin Calderwood went right through Marco and he ended up kind of hobbling around for most of the game. But we just didn't seem to get going in that game, and then got beat through a deflection of Gary Bennett. Probably could have been kind of a lot worse if it wasn't for Tony Norman.
We didn't perform. And in fairness, it's all right to say, Swindon were excellent. Swindon passed it like no other team passed it back in them days. I think there was a lad in midfield, Ross McLaren, he'd get the ball, he'd just switch it to either full-back or wing-back, as it was, whatever system they were playing. And we really laboured. Tony Norman was outstanding. Steve White, who actually probably missed about six chances. I live about 200 yards from him now, would you believe? So I don't speak to him loads, but, you know, it's really bizarre when you think that all those years ago we were playing against each other, and he could have won it by himself. Tony just pulled off save after save, which kept us in it. You know, it was nil-nil. The game was going on. And then I think, as you say, it was a deflected shot. Scrappy goal, really. Bit of an anti-climax, yeah. Yeah, we got beat, feeling rather sorry for ourselves. Long season over, nothing to show for it. And then pretty quickly after that, we got something, the news broke that Swindon were out and we were going to get promoted.
I found out on CFAX, I think, because there was talk.
No Sky News in them days.
No, none of that. There was talk of, because I think Newcastle were trying to go up, like you say, because they had a bit of an in. And I remember Ron Atkinson on the coverage for the World Cup was, the Sheffield Wednesday were relegated, and he was saying, kind of on St. Greavesy, I think, he was saying that they should stay in Division One. But, I mean, how did you find out that you were a First Division player?
I got a phone call, or it was on the news, or it just seemed to happen. It was 1 minute we were all sat there all feeling sorry for ourselves. The next minute was go and get your white tracksuit on again and meet in Sunderland somewhere. let's start the celebrations. But
yeah.
I mean, it's difficult. It was something that I don't think it's happened since. Probably won't happen again. Well, maybe it's not. Something similar might happen because of what's going on at the minute. But we were, at the time, you know, we were flying at the end of the season. We were the team in form. I'm not saying that means that we deserve to go up, but, you know, we felt like we'd finished the season successfully. It was obviously disappointing to lose against Swindon, but, you know, we were fortunate, and you're never going to turn that opportunity down, so we all got on with it.
Well, that's it. You're now a First Division player, and we're going to the First Division, which is pretty incredible, considering we were in the Third Division, what, 3 years earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, the job Dennis Smith did. And the other thing to it as well, I mean, from the Third Division, I mean, I think you've kind of touched on it a little bit as well, but all the way up to the First Division, it was pretty much the same group of players that did all that.
Yeah, same young lads having the time of their life playing for one of the biggest and the best clubs in the country, best supporters. And, you know, we just got on with it. We played hard. We'd had a little bit of success. And we, in fairness, when we had the chance to enjoy it, we did. We made the most of it. Like I said, that group of players made friendships that lasted a lifetime. Really, really good times. And you think, where am I now at this point? 22, maybe 22. Really, really young lad, and playing every week for Sunderland. Unbelievable.
Early in the season, I mean, our first two home games that season, Tottenham Hotspur, who have Lineker and Gascoigne fresh from Italia 90. Then we play Manchester United at home, and you get the first goal in a 2-1 win at Roger Park, with Gary Bennett turning into Pelé in the last minute to win it. I mean, you got good memories of that day?
Well, I have, but I should have scored the first goal against Tottenham. You know, that was a massive game. Gazza just signed for Tottenham. I think I got put through in the second half, 1v1, with Eric Torsved. And I just nicked it and got there before him, and it went the wrong side of the post, but I should have scored. I think Gascoigne, he hit the post with a free kick at some point in the game, and then obviously you think, bloody hell, we just got a point against Tottenham, so that gave us a bit of confidence.
We should have won.
You look at the game you're playing next, you're thinking, well, to be fair, we'd lost at Norwich, hadn't we? We'd lost at Norwich opening. We'd lost 3-2. You know, come back in the game after being out of the game. And then you think, we've got Man United next. Like, oh. And again, just you're playing against lads, Bruce, Pallister, Ince, that you'd been watching on the television for a couple of seasons, and now you're playing against them. I know you play against one or two of them in your earlier days in the youth team or reserve team games. Now it's for real. The goal, again, I think cross from the left-hand side. I was coming in from the right. I thought, I'm just going to just gamble. We just run into the box and see what happens. And got on the end of it. Header, whatever, goes in. And I'm running off. Even when I see it now, I think, I've just scored against Man United. What's going on here? It's like, I've just scored against Man United. And then I think they obviously equalised. And I do remember that they really got going, Man United, in the second half. And we were struggling. We were like, they really took control of the game. We were working hard. And that was, you know, one of the themes. Oh, that was how we did work hard. We, you know, when we were successful, no team worked harder than us. We had a lot of players that covered a lot of distance and put the yards in. And that goal, Benno's, he's a great friend of mine, and fantastic footballer, centre half, you know, ahead of his time when he played a ball playing centre half. That goal, it's still one of the best goals I've ever seen. You know, he's on the left wing. You have to ask him what he's doing on the left wing for a start, because he shouldn't have been there. So he must have thought he was on a night out again and got lost. So he's on the left wing when he should have been centre half. And he flips it over the lad's head. And then you're thinking, well, what's he going to... And he picks his spot and bends it in the corner. It was unbelievable goal. And obviously a great victory.
Well, I'm actually sitting here. I've got a big framed signed picture of Gary Bennett stroking the ball home.
Have you?
that goal. Looking at it now.
I worked out quite early on as well. I never scored the goals myself, but if you got there quick for the celebration, you had a chance of being in the paper the next day. So I was probably first one there when you scored. Well, I was trying to see if I can get on telly.
Well, I was right behind him in the main stand paddock. And I obviously can't remember this at the time, but reading in Dennis Smith's book, you actually mentioned it there. I think Dennis Smith was screaming at him to get back, saying, what's he doing up there in left wing?
Doing up there,
And it was Gary Pallister. He flicked it inside and then struck it right into the corner.
That was, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. And then you walk off and you think, we had four points. Yeah, well, was it four? It was probably only three, was it? Was it still 2 points in them days?
No, it was 3 points.
Three points. We got 4 points against Tottenham and Man United. Not a bad week's work.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, I mean, that season, you ended up being the only ever-present in the league that season. Because in the summer, Dennis Smith replaced McPhail with Kevin Ball, and then Eric Gates with Peter Davenport. We still had a really small young squad. I mean, you were 21, 22. Mark McGrabbadeen was the same age. Armstrong was about 22. And then behind that, we had the likes of Richard Orr, Paul Williams, Brian Atkinson, Kieran Brady, David Rush, Warren Hall.
Yeah,
they were all 17, 18. Yeah, but we were always going to struggle with that squad.
Yeah, when you look back, it's amazing. I mean, I think I played every minute of every game. And so you can probably blame me for getting relegated if you want. But, you know, it's another proud achievement, actually. You look at things and I think I stayed on the pitch and played every moment of all the games. And not a lot of people would do that at any level in this day and age. But we were young. We were inexperienced. We didn't have enough. Really, over the course of the season, there were times when we get a win and they were always hard-earned wins at that level, playing against top-quality opposition. And, I mean, sadly, it was close. It was close at the end of the season, but obviously we didn't do enough and we got relegated.
For a decent chunk of that season, Dennis Smith moved you back to right-back and you had games on the right, on the left, you mentioned, in the middle. But at one point, Dennis Smith came out and said he thought you were actually a future England right back. But do you think changing positions like that worked against you in the end?
Possibly. Think back, like I said, I made my debut on the left wing. So for Sunderland, I played left wing, right back, centre midfield. And I remember playing left back against Crystal Palace and John Sulaco. one evening. You know, I probably should have stood up for myself a little bit more, because I was, in terms of having games under my belt, and I probably could have went in and said, look, I want to play. I always felt my best position was in the middle of the pitch. And when he come out and made that statement, I probably hit the ground running, give them something different. We weren't really playing wing-backs at that time, although they weren't far away. If we were playing sort of wing-back position at that time, that might have suited us. But I did what I was told. You know, I wanted to play. I was asked to play in different positions for the team and for the club, and often I did.
I mean, you kind of touched on there with kind of wing-backs, but one comment I wanted to make about that side under Dennis Smith is, especially in this season in the First Division, we always played good football under Dennis Smith. We had a lot of people commenting on how, you know, well we played the game that year, and we just attacked. I mean, was that always the message from...
I can't remember Dennis ever going into a game and saying, we'll try and get a draw, or we'll... And, you know, he believed in his team. He made you feel good, and Buzzer, and then Crosser as well when he was involved. And it was, I think actually, it might have been our downfall. It was, we did go and try and win every game. It doesn't matter. You know, we went to Anfield and had a go. I know I scored an own goal, but I remember going to Tottenham. I think it was Christmas. And it was one of the best games of the season. Sunderland fans got there late, a lot of them, because of the bad weather. We went to Tottenham and we played them off the park. I think we went 2-0 up, nearly 3. I sort of had a shot from probably about 40 yards, I think. Tried to chip the keeper. I thought it was going in. Torsved saved it. Tottenham made a late sub. I think Paul Walsh come on, as he had done at that time, a few times for them, changed the game. Anyway, I think Tottenham ended up being 3-2 up, and we come back and drew 3-3. But that was epitomised what we were trying to do. We feared no one. We were going to Tottenham, Paul Gascoigne, Gary Lineker, whoever, and we were going to try and win. You'd never go back, and you can't change history. Maybe if we'd been a little bit more defensive, things might have been different.
It was a little bit kind of frustrating looking back, and maybe a kind of consequence of the young squad. But someone made a comment about something that season, saying we lost more leagues than Inspector Clouseau, because we actually managed to lose 11 games that season where we took the lead.
Well, it shows that we were trying to win games.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I've ever heard that. So that's really interesting. And again, just sort of backs that up. If we'd been a different type of team, maybe history might have been different, but it's not.
Get the final day of the season, and we still had half a chance of staying up. But I think what happened was, I think the fans showed the appreciation to the players and Dennis Smith and the backroom staff that day. We made it feel like a home game. But I think even though we ended up getting relegated on that day, I think the players were treated like heroes, despite the fact we went down. And I think it was a bit of an emotional day for everyone that day.
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, just leading up to that, I think the week before, we'd drawn with Arsenal, didn't we, on the live game. I'd had a chance, played a 1-2 with Marco on the edge of the box, tried to bend one in the top corner, and I'm thinking, it's in. David Seaman got a fingernail on it, and that was crucial. I think, I don't read many books, only the ones where people slag us off, but actually, David Seaman wrote about that save in his book and said it was one of the best saves that he ever made. If that had gone in, things might have been different for us, but we went to Main Road, and that 15, it was, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen support like it again, unless the cup finals, or do we ever see support like that again? 15,000, we were heroes. Again, we took the lead. I think we took the lead. Great goal. I think, I know I made a big mistake in the game, slashing at a ball that I should have, you know, was just caught up in the emotion of the game, and proved costly. Yeah, and it was sad, really, because, you know, we'd been on a roll, and we weren't used to not being successful. We'd played a couple of seasons where we won most weeks. We learned a lot during the season. If we'd managed to stay up, I think we would have been much better for it. And obviously that was the point at which things maybe started to change for us.
Started going a bit downhill following season with, you know, poor start. And Marco was sold fairly early on. I mean, did that seem inevitable that Marco, maybe even a few others, you know, like yourself or Gordon Armstrong, would leave after the win straight back down?
Yeah, I never, you know, there was stuff going on and I'd never asked to move. I didn't have an agent. I wasn't, you know, Dennis had looked after us. I knew that. Actually, when Marco went to Palace, I'd been dragged in. Dennis had said, "You're going with him." And I said, "All right." But I think, and again, it's funny how things were, and this is true. So Dennis, I goes in the office, he went, "Mark was going to Palace, you're going with him, but we're trying to do a swap for Paul Borden," who's at Palace, Welsh left back.
Yeah.
Fair enough, anyway, that lingered on a couple of days. He says, "No, he won't come to the Northeast, Paul Borden." And anyway, 2 weeks later, he signed for Newcastle. But I play golf with Paul now. He's another one sort of down this way. He played for Swindon, so he's sort of my golf partner. And I asked him, I said, "By the way," I says, "when I was going to come to Crystal Palace and you were going to come to Sunderland and you didn't come and my move broke down, why did you not come to Sunderland?" And he said, "I never heard a thing about it." So I don't know what was going on. I mean, I'd also seen Steve Cottle over the years. He'd always said to us, "Yeah, I did try to sign you once." And a few others have. Howard Wilkinson, I remember saying he tried to sign us when he was at Leeds. There was plenty of speculation, but I stayed, didn't want to go. I'd signed at one point, I think, a 4-year contract and then committed to Sunderland.
Dennis Smith was sacked just before Christmas, and it came after a bit of a fallout between him and Viv Busby before Dennis Smith left. But did that have a huge impact on the squad? Because you'd come through all that kind of promotion and disappointment and celebration with the two of them, and then that partnership split up.
It was disappointing. I think it was one of the most disappointing things that happened. You know, they were great, obviously great friends. The families were friendly. They'd been together for years, played together. They'd been at York together, had success, enjoyed many good times, had great times with us, with the players. Socially, they were both unbelievable company. So I can't say that it wasn't a shock, because it was. I mean, you know, Crozer, Malcolm was caught in the middle, which I can't think was very nice for him. He'd come in, he was another great bloke. He'd worked with the young players, encouraging them, done well with the reserves. And I think pretty much one day Dennis had decided, maybe you don't know. Sometimes you think you've got to change things. We'd been used to winning. We obviously weren't getting the results. Maybe Dennis felt a bit under pressure. And Dennis being Dennis, like we've already said, he was never scared to make brave decisions. He'd put young players in, he'd left players out, and he made another brave decision.
Yeah. Well, the whole decision around Dennis Smith seemed a bit strange, because he just signed Don Goodman, John Byrne and Anton Rogan. But then a couple of weeks later, you know, he's got these new players, and then a couple of weeks later, he's got the sack.
Yeah.
But did the squad kind of, were the squad surprised, or was the writing on the wall, do you think?
Everyone was shocked when, you know, for Dennis and Viv to fall out. Well, I'm not saying they did fall out, but obviously the one minute they weren't together, the next they're not. Of course, everyone was shocked, but, you know, you go in, you get on with it. Malcolm was a good coach. The sessions are different. It's a different voice. You know, there wasn't a problem there. The new lads come in. I have to say, three brilliant lads. Don, who's done very well for himself, end up sharing a room with Don. Anton, who I still speak to, and John Byrne, three brilliant lads. And they got the, obviously there was plenty of banter flying around there. They're getting rid of the manager that had bought them, but they're sort of, you know, they stood firm. And again, they were part of what happened next, and a little bit of success on the way to playing in the cup final. Although, unfortunately for Donny, he was cup tied, so he missed out on that.
You missed out on a lot of that, because you didn't play in any of the cup games except the final.
Nah, you're wrong, because I played against Port Vale. If I remember, I played in would have been the third round. I played against Port Vale, which obviously we won.
Yeah.
So you'll have to start sack your statistician.
I'm done. That's me finished. I was at that game as well.
Fake news. I got an injury. It was an injury that no one knew much about at the time. People wanted to operate. I didn't do any, have an operation. I chose rehabilitation. Very, very frustrating period. And in the end, I was sat about doing however many sit-ups a day. Like, I had the best six-pack in town in them days. I think that's all I did. All I could do was sit-ups. I think Malcolm just had been sent home. And Malcolm, by this time, I think was a caretaker manager. He just rang us up one day. He said, what are you doing? I says, I've been told to rest. Stay off my feet. I've done nothing for, like, I hadn't trained for weeks and weeks. He went, do you feel all right? I went, I feel all right. He says, come in tonight. We're playing Ipswich. I'm putting you on the bench. I'm like, what? Like, I've been sat at home. Anyway, he did. And we played Ipswich at home. And I think I come off the bench. And I think I set a goal up straight away. And sort of just got chucked back in. Got through straight back in. Played a few games towards the end of the season. And then obviously all this is going on while I think we were fighting against relegation again. We were struggling in the league. But we had this thing going on with the cup. The lads had been on this brilliant cup run. I'd been to all the games. Again, the spirit in the camp was fantastic. We'd started travelling to away games on the train, and that was all part of the experience. The lads had we used to listen to the Pogues on the bus at the end of the game, and we'd all be having a sing song and a beer, and you know, got us to the final. Obviously, went down to Bisham Abbey again. Things that happen that you think, I tell people, I think you're making this up. So we travelled down to Bisham Abbey, and we're watching, what's that film? You're All Under Arrest. Naked Gun.
Gun. Oh, right, yeah, cool.
So we're watching that film all the way down. We're having a little after that, and we get to the having our evening meal. And the bloke, the star, Leslie, is it Leslie Nielsen? That's him. Leslie, yep. Nielsen sat on the opposite table to where we've just been watching. This is a true story. We're watching, and one of the lads goes, there's that bloke that's out the film, Leslie Nielsen. And he was sat there having a meal with someone. He'd come over and he had a chat, and we'd give him a tie. And he arrested us all. You're all under arrest, which got a little bit of a giggle. Actually, it wasn't the first time that happened. And the same thing happened. We played Stoke away, and we watched Chubby Brown on the way down. We get the hotel, and Chubby Brown walks downstairs. I can't tell you what he said to us. But it's just like them things, like you see people in hotels. But anyway, sort of off the subject a bit, we go down to Bisham Abbey. I'm sharing with Don. Don's suspended, cup tied. I've been put with him at the start of the training session. Maybe, looking, actually something that just flashed across my mind there, probably might have been a bit of thinking somewhere that would put them two together. They're not going to be playing when I just think back all of a sudden. But obviously went down there. I'd played the last league game of the season. I think I played the last couple of league games. So I thought, well, I've finished the season in the team. I'd like to think I've got a chance. Although obviously he'd had different teams in the cup, and all those lads that were less fortunate that had been playing in the cup games would have been disappointed if they'd been left out. But went to Bisham Abbey. I actually picked up an ear infection again. Had a couple of days in bed, really, really painful, bit off colour. And then it was later in the week, I think, Casey, in fairness to him and the mark of the man that he was, he'd had a calf injury, and he put his hand up, and it would have been easy for him. If he could have played in that game, he would have. So it must have been bad. He would have, like, pretty selfless, really, what he did. Amazing, if you think about it. He got a chance to play in the cup final, and he declared himself unfit. And I probably did benefit from that. You know, if you think of where else I could have played in midfield, probably Paul Bracewell and Brian Atkinson had been doing really well. Rushy had been doing really well, wide on the right. So I can't say that I would have, you know, I would have fitted in there. So I don't know. Maybe I was slightly fortunate.
So, onto the game itself, how did you find the game? Because I still think about some of those moments in that first half.
Yeah, we had moments. Again, it was, you get to Wembley, the club had managed to get it. We were staying in Marlow. We were staying like miles away from it. We couldn't get a hotel. We couldn't get a hotel in London for some reason. So we're like, you know, you have the build-up, and you used to sit and watch it, and the teams are going to the ground about 1 o'clock to get to Wembley. I think we're on the bus like at 11:30, probably travel sick by the time we get there. We've got Tony Gubber in the helicopter flying above, and, you know, we had to, like, rush our pre-match, and, like, you better get on the bus now, otherwise we'll be late. So I don't know how that panned out, but that was obviously something else that, you know, it shouldn't have happened. We should have been in London somewhere. We weren't. We were miles away. But anyway, we got there. Wembley, I remember again, was almost waterlogged. And you're thinking, goodness me, it was, you know, it was really, really bad, heavy pitch. Kicked off, had a few moments. Bernie had that chance, didn't he? Half a chance for him to score in every round, which would have been great. Didn't happen. And then we toiled in the second half. Liverpool got hold of the game. They went 2-0 up. You know, that they passed the ball around us. We couldn't get near them. And again, disappointment at the end of it. Just recall sort of Wembley had the biggest baths in the world. Sat in one of them baths for about an hour. Just sat there sort of all doom and gloom. And eventually get yourself ready and head off into the night.
Yeah, Liverpool showed their class in that second half. It was pretty disappointing because they're just... But at this point, you're still only 23. You've got about 200 appearances to your name, two promotions, one relegation, playoff final appearance at Wembley, and an FA Cup appearance at Wembley.
I played in that other game at Wembley as well. Been there three times. Remember when we were in Division 3, they had that centenary competition. So I played in that. I'd actually played at Wembley three times.
Well, we got beaten in that one in the first game.
Oh, yeah, of course we got beaten. It was at Wembley.
Wembley, yeah.
Well, I think that was bizarre. It was a 20 minutes each way. We played Wigan. Yeah. Somehow we played Wigan, who'd qualified in the same league as us. So we were obviously favourites. And I recall it was a draw and it went to penalties. And Colin Pascoe walked up and as he was walking up, he pointed to the corner. He said, the goalkeeper, I'm going to put it there. And he did put it there, and the goalkeeper dived that way and saved it. Said, thank you very much. So, that was that.
Yeah, it was played over 2 days, that wasn't it? Because I'm sure the second day, on the first day, they'd got like a big crowd. And I'm sure on the second day, hardly for the finals, nobody turned up. It was like half a.
Yeah, it was. They did it, and again, they tried it, and at least I got a new suit out of it.
But you squeezed into the course of about 5 years, what some players would consider kind of a whole career, the amount of games you played and
This is what I'm lucky, you know. I always say I'm lucky, I tried my best, I put a lot into it, and people talk to us about playing for Sunderland and I'm proud of my record. I think if you look, I might not be exact, I think I played about 325 games, which would put us at number 25, I think, in the all-time list of appearances, which I think is something to be really proud of. I did that. You know, I left when I was 25, and I did that in a very short period, and it was a long time ago. And, it was a big number of games, and, you know, you look at some of the other people that might be up there. Gordon definitely would have played a lot of games. Mickey Gray was coming on the scene behind me. He played a lot of games. So there was a group of us that, you know, we give a lot to the club.
I mean, after that cup final, it kind of started to get a bit worse for some of them. But on a personal level, you were still in the first team for the majority of the time. But now we start moving into the reins of Terry Butcher and Mick Buxton. I mean, was it just a case of making managerial appointments that just weren't right for the club at the time?
Listen, I could sit here now and start having a go at people. I don't think, you know, in the current times, I don't want to be personal with anyone. I read Terry Butcher's book. He slagged us off in his book. He pretty much said that I was one of the reasons why he got the sack. Again, if ever decided to tell a tale, there'd be 101 stories about that time I would put in any book, believe me. Mick and Mick Buxton, in fairness to Mick Buxton, he was a good coach. I have to say, at the time, he was a good coach. He'd done well with his team at Huddersfield. They'd spanked us a couple of times, I think, when he'd been manager. But it was just the team was breaking up. The spirit, I felt the spirit went, you know, I lost a bit of confidence. It went a bit. Not sour, but I was getting a bit of stick at the end of it, and probably deserved it. And actually, when it was time for me to leave, that was a disappointing time. It happened really quickly, almost overnight, around about the Christmas time. My last game was against Bristol City for Sunderland. I didn't know at that point that they would be next week. I'd be playing for Bristol City, and yeah. You know, I'd been there. It was my 10th season. Other lads were getting testimonials and that hadn't been there as long as me or played as many games, and I was sort of getting kicked out the back door, which was, you know, when I went, it was sort of probably with a little bit of a whimper. And then it was always the biggest, saddest thing for me still to this day is that I never got a chance to go back ever and play against Sunderland for any of the clubs that I went on to play for.
Well, one thing I was going to ask about the move was it was only 3 months before Peter Reid was appointed and came in and replaced Mick Buxton, and it all took off. I mean, you were still only 26. Did you ever think about what might have been if you stayed until Reid was appointed?
Yeah, and I'd got to know Peter a little bit because he was big pals with Brace. Spent a bit of time in his company. We played against Man City when we were in the top division. He'd stayed over in Sunderland. We'd had a night out. He'd sort of made a point of saying how well he thought I'd done. He'd also sort of consoled us a bit when we'd been relegated at Man City when he was obviously the manager. Who knows? And the big thing that it's obvious what the lads that I kept in touch, he got that team spirit going straight away. They got on a roll, and I'm somewhat, although I had my time, and no one could ever take that away from me, and some of the days I've had with some of them lads, some of the laughs that we've shared, obviously he got all that going again, and I've heard many a tale of some of the things that happened when he was in charge. But it goes hand in hand with success. If you've got a good spirit in your dressing room and off the pitch, that can definitely help you, your chances on the pitch.
A little bit unfortunate, but after you went to Bristol City, then after Bristol City you had spells at Notts County, Forest Green, and then you moved into coaching and management, where you've had kind of a list of coaching management roles at Bristol City, Plymouth Argyle, Motherwell, Gateshead. Recently you were manager of Torquay United in the last couple of years. And now you hold the role of head of player development for the National League. Mm-hmm. So it sounds pretty wide-ranging, but what does that mean?
Well, it's basically what I've done in the last year, quite quickly, is set up 22 new licensed academies for National League clubs, which is a new concept. I've also started two new divisions for National League clubs in the north and National League clubs in the south, which we'll add to when football returns. So it's given really the clubs at that level the opportunity to develop their own players, young players, which is really important. You know, they don't have the resources, they don't have the finances. Some very good people working at these clubs, by the way, very good coaches and some very good young players. So that's the aim of that sort of role. Behind that, there's a situation where any of these young players that are under 18 can be poached, if you like, from the bigger clubs for nothing. So we're looking at ways of trying to make sure that it's a more level playing field and that clubs at that level, non-league level, which are developing their own players, are compensated or rewarded in some way if the bigger clubs come in and sign their players. But, I mean, I've always been in football. I have lots of experience. I've been manager, assistant manager, head of recruitment, chief scout, head of community, head of coaching, youth team manager, academy manager. So I have lots of experience. And like I say, I love the game. And then hopefully I can stay in around it as long as possible.
Do you miss the dressing room and the kind of the training pitch?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a different role. I spend a lot of time on the road by myself. There's nothing like the banter in a changing room. Although as you move into coaching and management, you have to, unfortunately, keep out of that most of the time and sometimes be at the expense of the jokes rather than in on the jokes. But yeah, it's like having two lives in it. It's a long time since I played football. I don't go around shouting about it. There's you travel around the country, one or two people remember you. It's always nice when someone still comes up here and, like you're doing, sort of reminds you of what happened a long time ago. And like I say, I'm deep down, I'm very proud of my association, definitely with Sunderland. I only had three league clubs until I was 34, so I was always sort of a loyal servant. Everyone got the money's worth out of us. I played most weeks when I was fit. And then I went on sort of later in my career, not to give a bit back, but I didn't mind going and playing for enjoyment, a little bit more enjoyment, if you like, playing in the non-league, although actually it wasn't, because you still wanted to win every week, and there was that frustration that you couldn't do when you were 35 what you could do when you were 20.
Well, let's hope you can, we get back to some sort of level of normality soon, and you can get back into that role. It's an important role down in the non-league. But just a quick note before we finish. I have in front of me, before we finish, the Sunderland annual from 1990.
All right.
So in here, it has a page all about a 19, 20-year-old Gary Owers.
Oh,
of course.
I might have seen that recently. There's a question on there, but let's see if it's the right one.
Well, let's see what we've got, because a vital piece of information in this fact file is a list of your five favourite music records at the time.
All right.
I wondered if you fancy taking a guess at what you put in there.
Well, I love Supreme.
Oh, it wasn't in your top five.
Was it not?
No.
Not
when you were 20 year old.
20. Oh, my God. Oh, this is getting scary now. Something by Alexander O'Neill.
Yes. You picked Criticize by Alexander O'Neill.
What? Yeah, was it 1990?
Yeah.
Alison Limerick, Where Love Lives.
Oh, dope. That's not in your top five.
This is getting embarrassing now.
I can put you out of your misery if you want.
Rick Astley.
No, he's not there either.
All right, come on then, let's go.
You've got I Knew You Were Waiting with George Michael and Aretha Franklin.
Yeah,
you've got Big Fun by the Gap Band.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
You've got Easy Lover, Phil Collins, of course. That's it.
I look like him now.
And then you've got Criticize, Alexander O'Neill, as we said. And then you've got Something Just Ain't Right by Keith Sweat.
Oh, did I really? Well, I think I would probably just come back from Magaluften and I must have heard that somewhere. No, times have changed.
There you go. I might have a read of the rest later on.
Yeah, about 9:30, that'll send you off for the night.
Well, on that note, I just want to say thank you very much for your time, Gary. As you said, you're a bit of a hero of mine, and I've loved the chance to speak to you about all those great times, and we all really appreciate it, so thanks for that.
Thank you, and just love to all Sunderland supporters. Hope you all get through this tough time, and see you all at the Far Post.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.